Have you ever had one of those moments where a mathematical concept you thought you understood completely suddenly turns upside down when you change just one parameter?
Absolutely. Usually that parameter is the number of dimensions. Our brains are so hardwired for two or three dimensions that when you scale things up to hundreds or thousands, our physical intuition just completely breaks down.
Right, and that's exactly what happens with high-dimensional Gaussians. We're going to talk about why they end up behaving like soap bubbles. This discussion is actually inspired by a thread from September 2023, which itself was a reaction to Sander Dielemann's excellent primer on typicality.
It's a fascinating topic, because in one dimension, a standard normal distribution behaves exactly how we'd expect. If you picture a classic bell curve, the highest point, the peak density, is right at zero. Half of the probability mass sits between negative 1 and 1, and if you draw random samples, they cluster tightly around that center.
Exactly. The origin is the most popular spot. But if you take that same standard normal distribution and scale it up to, say, thousands of dimensions, something incredibly strange happens. The probability mass almost completely abandons the center. It concentrates on this incredibly thin shell far away from the origin, like the surface of a soap bubble.
It's so counterintuitive. The origin, or the center of the distribution, still technically has the highest pointwise density. If you look at any single point, the formula says the density is highest at zero. But if you actually sample points from this high-dimensional distribution, you will almost never find a single sample anywhere near zero.
This is what mathematicians call the concentration of measure. And as we'll discuss, it isn't just a quirky math puzzle. It is absolutely fundamental to how modern machine learning works, especially when we're talking about generative models like diffusion or autoregressive systems. To understand why this happens, we should start with a simpler toy example, hypercubes.
Yes, hypercubes are a great way to build intuition before we get into the calculus of Gaussians. Let's start with a simple 1x1 square in two dimensions. If you shrink each side of that square by just 5%, you get a smaller square that is 0.95 by 0.95.
Right, and if you calculate the area of that smaller inner square, it's 0.95 squared, which is 0.9025. This means the inner square contains about 90% of the original area. The remaining 9.75%, roughly 10%, lives in that thin outer 5% border, or shell, around the edge. Now let's step up to three dimensions, with a 1x1x1 cube. If we apply the same 5% shrinkage to each of the three dimensions, we get an inner cube that is 0.95 by 0.95 by 0.95. The volume of that inner cube is 0.95 cubed, which is roughly 0.857. So now the inner core only holds about 86% of the volume. That means we've carved out about 14% of the volume just by taking that 5% shell off the outside. The shell is getting thicker in terms of how much volume it contains, even though its physical thickness is still just 5%.
Exactly. Now let's push this to the extreme. Imagine a 100-dimensional unit hypercube. If we shrink each of those 100 dimensions by 5%, the volume of the remaining inner core is 0.95 to the power of 100. If you run that math, it comes out to roughly 0.0059.
That is less than 1% of the original volume. To be precise, about 0.6% of the volume is left in the center. That means a staggering 99.4% of the total volume of that 100-dimensional hypercube lives entirely within that paper-thin 5% outer shell, near the surface. It really highlights how the center of a high-dimensional hypercube is essentially empty. And the crucial thing to realize here is that this isn't some unique property of Gaussians or normal distributions. This is a fundamental geometric fact about how volume scales in high dimensions. The surface area of a shape explodes exponentially as the number of dimensions increases. Because of that, even an incredibly thin shell near the boundary ends up containing almost all of the available space. It's a wild realization. If you want a more formal proof of this concentration phenomenon, there are excellent lectures on high-dimensional geometry that walk through the mathematics rigorously, but the core intuition is right there in the scaling. So let's talk about why the surface dominates so aggressively. If we look at a d-dimensional ball, the volume scales proportional to the radius raised to the power of d, or r to the d. When the dimension D is high, that exponential dependence on the radius means that if you shrink the radius by even a tiny fraction, you are carving out a massive chunk of the total volume.
Right, because if you have R to the D, and R is slightly less than 1, raising it to a high power, like 100 or 1,000, drives that value down to almost 0. Conversely, it means the vast majority of the volume has to concentrate near the maximum radius, on that outer shell.
And it's not just the volume of the ball itself. The surface area of concentric shells also scales exponentially. So even if you have a distribution where the probability density is technically highest at the center, like a Gaussian, you have to multiply that pointwise density by the volume of the shell at that radius to find out where the actual probability mass lies.
Exactly. You can think of it as a tug of war. On one side, you have the density gradient, which is pulling you toward the center because the density is highest at the origin. On the other side, you have the volume expansion, which is pulling you outward because there is exponentially more space as you move away from the center. In high dimensions, the volume expansion wins by a landslide. Geometry completely overwhelms the density gradient.
It's so hard to visualize because our daily experience is limited to 3 dimensions, where this effect is relatively mild. In high dimensions, the rules of the game change. The center is sharp, meaning the density peak is high, but it is practically empty because there's no volume there to hold any samples.
So now let's apply this geometric insight directly to Gaussians. Let's look at the math. Consider a standard multivariate Gaussian in D dimensions, written as normal with mean 0 and identity covariance matrix, ID. We can think of this as a D-dimensional random vector x, where each coordinate x1, x2, all the way to xd is independently drawn from a standard 1D normal distribution with a mean of 0 and a variance of 1.
Right. Now, if we want to know how far a sampled point is from the origin, we use the Euclidean norm. That's the square root of the sum of the squared coordinates, the square root of x1 squared plus x2 squared all the way to xd squared.
Since each coordinate is independent with a variance of 1, we can calculate the expected squared norm. The expectation of the sum of xi squared is just the sum of the expectations of each xi squared. And since each coordinate has a mean of 0 and variance of 1, the expectation of xi squared is exactly 1.
Which means if you add up d of those, the expected squared norm is exactly d. If we take the square root of that to get the actual distance, the typical radius of a sample from the origin is going to be right around the square root of d.
Let's put some real numbers to this to make it concrete. Imagine we are in 100 dimensions, so d equals 100. The average length of a sample vector is going to be the square root of 100, which is exactly 10.
Now, you might think, okay, if the average is 10, maybe the samples are scattered all over the place, some at 2, some at 5, some at 15, but they aren't. They concentrate in an incredibly narrow band. In 100 dimensions, the shell between radius 8 and radius 12 contains about 99% of all samples.
Think about that. A thickness of 4 units around a radius of 10. In relative terms, that is a very thin band. And as the dimension D grows even larger, this shell gets even tighter. By the time you reach 1,000 dimensions, almost every single sample lands in a window that is just a few percent wide relative to the total radius. The distribution literally looks like a hollow soap bubble. This brings us to a really profound paradox: the difference between what is typical versus what is likely. For a high-dimensional Gaussian, the region around the origin still contains the most likely individual samples, in terms of point-wise density. If you ask, which specific point in the entire space has the highest probability density, the answer is still the origin, 0. But those points near the origin are extremely atypical, because they are so incredibly rare.
Right. Most samples live on that soap bubble shell, the typical set. These points on the shell have a much lower individual density than the points at the origin, but because there is an astronomical amount of space at that radius, they completely dominate the total probability mass.
It's a vital distinction. The typical set is the region where the total probability mass approaches 1, even though no individual point inside that set has an exceptionally high density. When we are reasoning about sampling or compression or anomaly detection in high dimensions, thinking about the typical set is a much better mental model than thinking about peak probability.
Let's look at the math of why this happens again, just to make sure the mechanics are clear. The Gaussian density function, P of x, is proportional to the exponential of negative norm of x squared over 2. This function peaks at 0 and decays exponentially as you move away. But to find the actual probability mass in a region, we have to integrate that density over the volume.
And as we established, the volume of a sphere in high dimensions scales like r to the d. So when you integrate, you are multiplying that decaying exponential density, e to the minus r squared over 2, by this exploding volume term, r to the d.
Exactly. The product of those two curves peaks sharply away from the origin, specifically right around the square root of d. If you want to get a sample near the origin, you need all d coordinates to be very close to zero simultaneously. Since they are independent, the probability of that happening is the product of those individual probabilities, which drops exponentially fast as the dimension d increases. It's practically impossible.
This has massive implications for machine learning. Sander Dileman summarized this perfectly in his post on typicality. He wrote that if we want to learn more about what a high-dimensional distribution looks like, studying the most likely samples is usually a bad idea. If we want to obtain a good quality sample from a distribution, subject to constraints, we should not be trying to find the single most likely one. Yet, in machine learning, these are things that we do on a regular basis.
That quote really cuts to the heart of generative modeling. Think about how we train these models. Log likelihood-based training naturally rewards models that place probability mass where the real data lives, which is in that typical shell. But if you then try to generate new data by naively chasing the mode, the single point with the highest density, you end up falling into the empty center of the bubble. You generate these highly pathological, weird outputs that look nothing like real data.
It explains so many behaviors in generative modeling that seem puzzling at first. Take beam search in natural language processing, for example. Beam search is designed to find the highest probability trajectory of words. But because it's chasing the mode, it often pulls the outputs away from the typical set and toward these highly repetitive, bland, or unnatural sentences. It's trying to maximize point-wise probability, but in doing so, it leaves the typical set of natural human language.
Another great example is anomaly detection using likelihood thresholds. You might think that if you want to detect outliers or anomalies in high-dimensional data, you can just calculate the likelihood of a sample under a trained model. If the likelihood is low, it's an anomaly. If it's high, it's normal. But that fails catastrophically because outliers can easily sit in a region with high individual density, or conversely, perfectly normal data points live in the typical shell, where individual density is actually quite low. High likelihood doesn't mean normal or typical in high dimensions. It often just means you've drifted toward the mode.
And then there's diffusion models and autoregressive samplers. Have you ever wondered why these models always inject noise during the generation process? It seems counterintuitive to add randomness when you're trying to create a clean image or text. But that noise injection is exactly what keeps the samples inside the typical shell. It prevents the generation process from collapsing onto the mode, which would result in those pathological, low-quality outputs.
It's like the noise acts as a centrifugal force, keeping the path on the surface of the soap bubble where the actual data lives, rather than letting it fall into the empty center.
Exactly. So if you are working with generative models or high-dimensional data, how do you translate these mathematical insights into practical design and debugging heuristics?
The first takeaway is that you should track norms, not just likelihoods. When you are evaluating samples from a generative model, don't just look at the likelihood scores. Check whether the Euclidean norms of your generated samples actually match the typical shell of the training data. If you see that the norms of your generated samples are consistently smaller or larger than the typical norm, that's a major red flag. It signals mode collapse or a fundamental distributional mismatch, even if your likelihood scores look perfectly fine on paper.
That's a really solid diagnostic tool. The second takeaway is to be incredibly careful with random projections. Because of the geometry of high dimensions, most directions are nearly orthogonal to each other. If you take a high-dimensional distribution and project it down to two or three dimensions so you can plot it on the screen, you can easily destroy that shell structure. The projection can make the distribution look completely different from what it actually is, leading you to make wrong assumptions about your data.
Right. A hollow sphere projected onto a 2D plane can look like a solid disk, completely hiding the fact that the center is empty. And the third takeaway is that simulation beats intuition. If you want to truly internalize this, don't just rely on the algebra. Write a quick script to sample from standard Gaussians as you scale the number of dimensions from 2 to 10, then 100, then 1,000. Plot the histograms of those sample norms. You will watch that annulus tighten right before your eyes. Seeing that transition happen in a simple simulation is far more convincing than any equation.
It really is. It changes how you think about high-dimensional spaces forever. Once you see that peak sharpen and move away from zero, the soap bubble metaphor clicks, and you start seeing it everywhere in your model's behavior.
It's a beautiful reminder that the geometry is talking to us. All of these seemingly weird behaviors in machine learning, why beam search collapses, why likelihood-based anomaly detection fails, why diffusion models need noise, they aren't bugs or mysteries. They are just the logical consequences of high-dimensional geometry. Once we stop forcing our three-dimensional intuition onto these models and actually listen to the geometry, those mysteries solve themselves.
Well said. It's all about aligning our intuition with the actual math of the space we are working in. If we do that, we can build much more robust and effective models.
That feels like the perfect place to wrap things up. Thanks for diving into the geometry of soap bubbles with me today, Theo.
Thanks, Maya.
It's always fun to look at the world through a high-dimensional lens.